Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, May 13th, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time and 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. And remember that our shows are archived on DrSaputo.com and PRN.FM. And guess where we are this morning?
Right. We're live in Bodega Bay, California, resorting at the beautiful Tides Inn, where we're having the luxury of using their office here to broadcast to you. So today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. And we've got a great show for you today. This is going to include going back to what happened in Fukushima, you know, about a year ago with that reactor number 4. This may shock you.
And why healthy babies should not be overprotected from germs.
And why probiotics can be used to prevent diarrhea. Where the hell has everybody been? We've known that for 20 years, and now it's in the mainstream medical journal, so it must be true.
And this is when you're taking antibiotics.
Right.
Also, brief training can improve resident physicians' empathy with their patients.
And what about Facebook addiction? Heard of that? Or these little cell phones and texting? Everybody's doing it. What you need to know about it.
And alternative medicine can help kick the smoking habit.
All right. If you want to join us in our conversation or you've got questions about our topics or something about your health, give us a call. The number is 888-874-4888.
Like you said, Fukushima was like the worst disaster of all time. So why don't we hear anything much about Fukushima anymore? We're going to talk about reactor number 4 and how an earthquake in Japan could release enough radiation to end human civilization on our planet.
Well, that's amazing. That's a strong statement, too. And, you know, this is all what-ifs to an extent, but we've underrated what's going on in Fukushima. You know, there are 11,000 spent fuel rods there that accounts for about 336 million curies that are just in radiation, but 134 of which are cesium-137, and that is a problem.
And how much would it take to kill us?
Try one curie can be fatal. And we've got 10 to 85 times the amount of radiation potentially in this whole mix there than there was in Chernobyl. And what's anybody doing to clean it up? Just about nothing. There's no cleanup that amounts to anything. The radiation's still sitting there. And back when Chernobyl was happening, 500,000 Russians sacrificed their health, and many of them died, because what they could do, they could make about 2 shovelfuls of dirt for each person before they had so much radiation that they'd be sick from it.
That's pretty amazing and overwhelming, isn't it, to think about this? I was just talking to my son in Alaska last night for Mother's Day, but he was mentioning the things that have been floating up to shore in Alaska that are from Fukushima.
This is a year later. So how much stuff do you think is coming across, and how much radiation do you think is possible?
Well, this fallout is poisoning our food and our water, our air, our soil, the sea life, everything.
Right.
And it could get a lot worse. So what can we do about it?
Well, there's a lot we can do. There are a couple of things I want to cover, though, first before we do that. And we're looking at something that if that nuclear reactor, number 4, which is suspended about 100 feet above the ground, sustains another earthquake of a magnitude of about a Richter 7, that thing could come down, and when it does, all those spent fuel rods that are in there are going to be a real issue, because they would melt. And if they did, you'd have a huge explosion, and you'd have an amount of radiation that we've just described. It would be enormous.
And radiation sickness can be horrible.
Right.
With the nausea and vomiting and diarrhea, all those intestinal symptoms, and what else would happen?
Well, you hit on the first thing, and that's the gut. It's either the cells that are the most liable or most vulnerable to radiation are those that turn over the fastest, and those are in two places, the gut, the intestinal tract, and the bone marrow. So if your gut cells turn over every 3 days and your bone marrow cells every week or two, for the most part, you're looking at a lot of damage there that gives you symptoms from those places. So
you could be bleeding and your immune system would be overcompromised.
Well, the bone marrow will take care of that part. You're right. The gut, of course, would give you nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and then all the other things that go with it. So These are huge problems for which it's very difficult, if the dose of radiation is enough, to do anything about.
But is it even worth it to talk about prevention as far as the health thing goes? I mean, the real prevention would be to do something about these reactors so that we don't get all this radiation poisoning, especially if there's like an earthquake. But if it did happen, is there anything that we can do now?
You bet. And we'll talk about that right now. But I want to just remind people that there's nothing being done like was done in Chernobyl. That mess in Fukushima with six reactors, not one, is continuing to go on. And admittedly, each of those reactors is about half the strength of Chernobyl, but there's six of them. So now we're looking at three times the possible impact that we had in Chernobyl. But you're right. Let's look at the mechanism of what causes the danger with radiation poisoning. And basically, it's pretty simple, because what does radiation do? It causes a production of something called free radicals, which are chemicals that form when radiation hits tissues of the body that make these chemicals that destroy anything they come in contact with. Those are the free radicals. And there's a balance there between free radicals and something called an antioxidant. And if you don't have enough antioxidant to mop up the free radicals that are forming, you're going to have damage to your tissues. They're going to cause all kinds of problems, particularly in the gut and the bone marrow.
Another reason to be living a healthy lifestyle.
You bet, because that's the way you can do something to make sure that you have those antioxidant reserves. What you eat is huge. Your diet is very important.
And exercise.
Exercise. You know, people don't realize how important exercise is to build up your antioxidant levels. And it's kind of a paradox, because when you have a lot of exercise going on, what happens is your body makes a ton of free radicals. And you think, well, that's not good. And, of course, it isn't good, but that's the price you pay for making energy, for making ATP. So the body has its own defense mechanisms that are antioxidant, and it builds up enormous levels of antioxidant levels. I know when I go to health food or go to fairs where they have these devices that measure antioxidant levels, I'm usually one of the ones that has the highest levels. And they always say, what are you taking? You must be taking a lot of antioxidants, because how else would it be like that? And I say, I don't take anything. And they go, what?
Because they're trying to sell you a lot of supplements.
Well, that's part of it. But they also are in disbelief because they brainwash themselves, too. The exercise builds up enormous reserves. And that's why people who exercise tend to be so much healthier and live so much longer with fewer problems with chronic inflammation.
And then there's foods that make a lot of difference, particularly foods that contain sulfur, like garlic and onions and the brassica family, those vegetables that are cruciferous, like cauliflower and broccoli and kale and Brussels sprouts and so forth, and eggs.
Yeah, so foods that are rich in sulfur make an antioxidant called glutathione, which is the most important antioxidant in the human body, intracellularly. So it's the stuff inside your cells that protects you. So without that, you're really doomed. And people who have chronic inflammatory diseases, you measure their glutathione levels, they're low. And then there are things like what's in green tea, the ECGC, and people who juice or use yogurt or sauerkraut, or the sea vegetables, a seaweed salad or miso soup or kimchi or watercress. Those are all great things that do a lot.
And ginger and beets and berries.
Right, yeah.
And filtered water. You know, if you drink filtered water, you can filter radiation out of it.
Or you filter out the particulate part, the cesium-137 that's in particles. You can filter that part out if it's not in solution. And that does a lot, too. Just like if the radiation comes across and there's a fallout, which is the problem, about 80% of it's on your clothes and your shoes. So you could do something about getting it off that way as well.
And sealing up your doors and windows.
Well, if it's that bad, yeah, you're probably cooked, but right.
Yeah. Also, there's supplements that people might want to stock up on. What would some of those be?
Well, things like vitamin A and beta carotene and vitamin E. Some people, vitamin D3 is a big one. That has a lot to do with not just antioxidant activity, but with making cells that are damaged and maybe moving towards cancer. It tends to cause them to reorganize in a way that's a lot more healthy and less cancerous. So that's a big thing there.
Also, brown seaweed extract is supposed to be helpful for that.
Right, and vitamin C. There's some interesting studies done on rats where they give them a lethal dose of radiation, all the rats die. And then they take another group and they give them a couple of grams of vitamin C and then radiate them again, and guess what? They don't die. So if you did something that's called taking your body to bowel tolerance of vitamin C, which means fully saturate what your body can take, and if you go to drsabuta.com and put that in the search box, you can learn more about how to do that.
Which is another reason why it's good to take vitamin C if you're going to have an x-ray.
Oh, before it, absolutely. That, with a little bit of vitamin E at the meal before that, will prevent that free radical damage. It causes lots of problems. You know, you do 1,000 mammograms, you're going to cause one breast cancer. Or if you do CT scans or PET scans, you're going to be causing cancers from that as well. So you might as well take a little vitamin C and a little vitamin E and protect against that the best you can.
Well, then there are things like lipoic acid and quercetin. What's with quercetin?
That's an interesting anti-inflammatory agent. And what it does is it helps to reduce the inflammation that's in the body. So once the free radicals form, this tends to quench it. So it's a beautiful thing to take. And so I recommend it.
And everybody likes to joke about the resveratrol in wine to have an excuse to drink red wine, but you need an awful lot of red wine to get enough resveratrol. So why is and how is resveratrol helpful?
Well, it actually blocks the damage from radiation. There were some interesting studies that were done that show that about 500 milligrams a day would do a lot to block the effects of radiation damage. Another really good one is L-glutamine. Now, that's just an amino acid, and you would think, well, why is that important? But basically what you're looking at there is an amino acid that's a major metabolic fuel of the gut. So when a gut is damaged and it's got inflammation in it and it's disintegrating, the least you could do for it to try and protect it is give it the energy it needs to repair itself. So the L-glutamine in a dose of maybe a couple of teaspoons a few times a day is a good idea.
And then there are things like zinc and selenium and whey products. What about probiotics? What do they do?
That information's shocking to me, because a study that was just done in the last about year showed that if you take probiotics and then you irradiate animals, they don't die from the irradiation so much, and I haven't got a clue why, but it's an interesting outcome study that I think is really important. So this is a fascinating area of what you can do.
Well, then everybody always wants to know about the iodine, too, like how much iodine to take.
Well, iodine has a half-life of just 8 days. So if it's coming over in one big pulse, taking a big dose of iodine will flood the thyroid gland with normal iodine, not the radioactive stuff, so that when the radioactive stuff comes along, the iodine will already be saturated in the thyroid, and it won't need to be able to absorb it anymore. And so that'll protect your thyroid from having that problem.
What about taking thyroid?
Well, if you can take it long-term, the iodine-131 long-term, because it's not just a pulse, you can't just keep taking big doses of iodine. What you have to do is take a little thyroid hormone with it, and I recommend the desiccated thyroid, about a grain a day for that situation. Now, I want to make one thing clear. This is not advice we're giving people. This is information. If you're not our patient, can't treat you, but we can give you information that might be something that could save your life if something like this happens, but that should be done under the supervision of your doctor. And by the way, we have an outline of all this information about how to protect yourself against radiation on our website at drsaputo.com, and that's SAPUTO.com. So go to the home page, and there you'll see all this stuff. If you click on the radiation signs that are in the center of the home page, we just did a show on InfoWars with Alex Jones, using and Mike Adams interviewed us, and there was a lot of interest in what we're doing, and so we decided finally just to put it on the home site so people could click into it and get it.
We also have supplements now on our site.
Yeah, so if you're interested in that, that's a good place to go to learn more about what's there in terms of our health assessments. There are 33 health assessments there that look at almost any condition you want. And by the way, the site is 100% free. We don't charge for any information. So have a look at the site. Get the information for free. There are 2,000 audios and videos. And enjoy yourself. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputi here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's first 2020 tip.
Well, as you open your pockets for the next natural disaster, there's some facts that you might want to keep in mind. It's been reported that the American Red Cross president, the CEO, has a salary per year of $651,957 plus expenses.
Oh, is that all?
The United Way president receives $375,000 as a base salary, along with numerous expense benefits. UNICEF CEO has been reported to receive $1,200,000 a year, with $100,000 per month, plus all expenses, including, guess what, a Rolls Royce.
Of course.
So less than 5 cents of your donated dollar goes to the cause.
UNICEF.
Put your money in UNICEF. There's other choices here, like the Salvation Army. The commissioner receives a salary of only about $13,000 a year plus housing for managing this $2 billion organization, so 96% of donated dollars goes to the cause. And in sharp contrast, donations to help vets and their families and their youth go to the American Legion National Commander, who receives zero salary. So your donations actually go to really help the veterans and their families. The Veterans of Foreign Wars National Commander receives no salary. Your donations go to help the veterans and their families and their youth. The Disabled American Veterans National Commander receives no salary. Same deal. The Military Order of Purple Hearts National Commander, no salary. And the Vietnam Veterans Association National Commander doesn't receive a salary. So your donations for many of these veterans organizations and their families go to benefit their families and their youth. So think about it. Where will your donations go when there's a national disaster strike?
Right. A lot of these are really kind of sneaky because, yes, they got a good cause. Yes, they want to do some good things for people, but they're doing as much good for themselves as they are for the people in some of these organizations. And some organizations, like the American Cancer Society, should just be whipped. What they're doing is basically, it's such a scam. What they're doing is their money is going where? Indirectly to Big Pharma. Because who do you think funds a lot of what they do? It's the pharmaceutical industry. And why do they do that? Because Big Pharma has a knack for filtering money, laundering money, basically, if you will, through the American Cancer Society. So they'll do the dirty work. And then what happens is the sale of all kinds of drugs for chemotherapy, for radiation, and for surgery are all going back to different people who have these vested interests. So you have to be careful about where you might want to think before you pink. That's what they call that, huh, Vicki? And there's information on the site that talks about that in Vicki's Corner for those of you that are interested. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuti with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
So are you germophobic with your baby? I mean, why is it turning out to not be such a great idea? When I had my babies, we were taught in those days to really be careful about germs and to boil and sterilize all the nipples and the bottles, and if you were breastfeeding, to clean your nipples before each time you fed the baby. And now we're finding out that some of the bacteria is important for the health of our baby's guts.
They should be playing in the dirt. You don't need to sterilize all this stuff because those microbes that get into your baby's body will stimulate the immune system to develop. And without development, you don't have any way of making antibodies or of making cells that will fight against infections and cancer and other things.
And what does this have to do with allergies when you have a deficiency in your immune regulation from not the right bacteria?
Well, most of that, Vicki, comes from the role of the intestinal tract in immunity. And you go, what? What does the gut have to do with your immune cells? Well, a ton. Because, first of all, two-thirds of the immune cells that are in your body are where? They're in the gut. They're right around that tube, okay? About two-thirds of them. And the microbes that are in the intestinal tract, there are probably 1,000 different species of microbes, and 10 times as many microbes in the gut as there are cells in the human body. I mean, these are stunning numbers. And they live in a very complex ecosystem that does a lot of things that are valuable for our bodies. So what you have there is the normal flora being able to discriminate against what comes into the intestinal tract.
You know, now you're making me feel guilty.
Why?
Because my son has allergies, and when I was really good at cleaning up those germs. When he was in his playpen, he'd throw the toys out, and I'd pick each one up and wash them and put them back in, and he'd throw them out again, and I'd wash them and put them back. And
yeah.
By the time I had my second baby, I wasn't being so careful about it, and you know, he doesn't have any allergies.
Oh, that's too funny.
So that might have had something to do with that.
Well, anyway, those cells that are in the intestinal tract that are microbes, the friendly ones, can distinguish what's coming down. If pollen comes down, it analyzes the pollen and it sends a chemical messenger called a cytokine to the immune system. And what the immune system says or does is take directions from it, because the information that's coming says, don't get excited, it's just pollen. You don't have to make antibodies against pollen because it won't hurt you. But if you don't have those cells there, no message comes. The immune system might do anything, and it often does.
The other thing that people need to be aware of is to be really careful about these antibacterial wipes. A lot of people think they're doing the right thing. They're wiping their baby's hands with it and their little bottoms with it and, you know, using those all the time. And those are creating bacteria that are resistant to them, with antibiotics.
It doesn't create them, but what it does is it kills all the good guys and leaves the bad ones that are resistant to that particular disinfectant there to overgrow.
Okay, good. You said it a lot better.
Well, just got to get it right. That's all. But that was
close
to the idea.
But anyway,
right?
A lot of these antibacterials are very toxic, you know, like the triclosan. They're really dangerous, so it's not good to be using those. That's just like wiping pesticides on yourself.
Well, it's one of the reasons why you don't want to take antibiotics, you know, if you don't really need them. Because every time you take an antibiotic, what happens to the microbes in the gut? You're killing the ones that are sensitive to it, and you're allowing the ones that are resistant to it to have more turf to grow in, which you don't want. Because then those resistant microbes are going to be the most popular ones down there, unless you take a probiotic or something to stop that. So it's a really interesting conflict that we get stuck in. So for our kids, it's really important that we expose them to microbes that are in the soil and in the environment and in lots of different places. It doesn't mean take them to a place where somebody has whooping cough. That doesn't make any sense. But it sure makes a lot of sense to expose them to the usual childhood illnesses. You know, they're talking about a whooping cough, what they call epidemic now, in the state of Washington, because there have been 1,200 cases. Well, first of all, most of those cases are kids that have already been immunized. In fact,
so they're
getting it
from the immunization. That's great.
Well, that's actually true, because what you're looking at is these aren't babies getting it. These are kids that are 8 to 12. They've already had their immunizations, and, of course, the whooping cough immunization is not a good one to take in the first place because it doesn't last. It can have complications to it, and the disease itself doesn't kill people usually. So we don't have the studies. We need the clinical trials before we just start making statements saying that these immunizations are valuable. And I'll tell you, they're not there. I've checked for them. You go to your pediatrician, he says, oh, of course they're right. The CDC says it's right. But the CDC, you can trust about as far as you can throw it. I mean, the stuff that comes out of that office is despicable.
Well, they're in bed with the pharmaceutical companies, aren't they?
You better believe it. Where do you think Julie Gebberding, the head of the CDC, now works? For Merck Pharmaceuticals. And what does she do? She runs their immunizations, okay, all their production of their immunizations. And she was the one who was saying, oh, yeah, the swine flu vaccine is really important. You must take it. And if you want to know the truth about that, put in the infection deception, okay, in the search box in drsaputo.com, and up will come an article that I wrote for the Townsend Letter that was published, so it's well-referenced. That, to me, was one of the most lying, terrible things that the government has done. And it wasn't just the CDC. It was the FDA. It was the White House. It was the World Health Organization. This conspiracy, I followed every day for about a year, so I know that my facts are right, and the stuff that's published in this article in the Townsend Letter and on our site is documented with medical literature that came from where? The CDC. It's amazing some of the stuff that they do. All we need to do, if we want to show that these immunizations work or they don't work is a simple study that nobody's been willing to do. And that study would be you take one group of 100,000 people in some town and you immunize them to the swine flu or the whooping cough or whatever you want to, and you take another 100,000 in another town and you follow them and you don't give them anything. Then you see what happens. Do they get more whooping cough? And what about the group that had the vaccine? Do they have more complications? You might find the answer then. Why doesn't anybody do the study? Well, I can tell you, because it would probably expose the truth that nobody wants to know about. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back taking your calls and talking about some new things in healthcare after a short commercial break. I'm Dr. Len Sabuter with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We had a call from Matt in New York asking us for advice on supplements for a cancer patient. Matt, that's a huge topic, and I almost don't know where to start, but I can tell you we have videos on our website, drsabuter.com, that I want to refer you to, and also at least three health assessments that talk about what you do once you have cancer, how to manage breast cancer patients, and a third one on the supplements and the treatment that you can use that's integrative for cancer. So I'd rather refer you there because it gets too complicated. I could spend the next 3 or 4 hours talking about that. We also have a call from Alan. Alan, you on the line? Are you there, Alan? Well, it looks like
you... Good afternoon.
Are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
How you doing?
Hi. I'm calling about Parkinson's disease. I read some things on the computer that people were taking coconut oil. And I was wondering, you just take it orally, like a tablespoon, or...
Well, let me tell you about coconut oil. It's a saturated fat, and most people think it's bad for you, but it's one of the best oils out there as long as it's not rancid. If they use cracked coconuts that have fungus in it, they get aflatoxin, and that aflatoxin causes cancer and lots of problems. So if you buy a good quality coconut oil...
It's organic.
It's organic. It's a very good one to use because it provides an alternative fuel for the brain. So coconut oil for people who have Alzheimer's disease or MS or ALS or Parkinson's disease is a very smart thing to do because... In all these illnesses, what happens is we have an energy shortage. We don't have enough ATP, which is like what gasoline is to a car, ATP is to a cell. And when you put an alternative source in for energy in the form of coconut oil, what it does is it breaks down into what are called ketone bodies. And the brain can learn to use them. So it's like providing cells that are having like what an electrical brownout is like, you know, in the summertime. It will provide energy that will keep that from happening. And the brain in that setting really needs it. So using coconut oil is a really smart trick. And the dose is about 2 tablespoons 3 times a day used with your cooking. You don't need to take it straight.
Yeah, coconut oil is a great oil to use for cooking.
Mm-hmm. It's a saturated fat. It's not going to decompose because it doesn't have double bonds. And you can use it at relatively higher temperatures, although in general, I recommend cooking your food under about 340 degrees.
It's also good on your skin.
Real good for the skin. And a lot of that is absorbed right across the skin into the body. In fact, a lot of oils and a lot of chemicals that are on the skin do. For example, even drugs like progesterone, you put 10 milligrams of progesterone on the skin in a non-petroleum-based oil, you will need 100 milligrams of progesterone by mouth to get the same blood levels. So across the skin for some things is more permeable than when you're looking at taking it by mouth. So that's the story, Alan. Thanks for calling in. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
We've been talking a lot about probiotics today.
Okay.
And finally, the Journal of the American Medical Association has published findings on how important they are for those taking antibiotics and in preventing diarrhea that's associated with taking antibiotics 42% of the time.
So where the hell have they been for the last 25 years?
They haven't been listening to us.
You know, actually, there was a guy named Metchnikoff about 100 years ago, he was a Russian guy, who realized that the microflora of the gut was important, and it had a lot to do with whether or not we're healthy or not healthy. And when you disturb that ecosystem, you lose the ability to detoxify things, you lose the ability to crowd out things like candida and C. diff, and Shigella and all the other infections that can get into the gut. You stop those microbes from providing certain kinds of vitamins that we need, like vitamin K and B5 and a lot of other substances. So these microbes are not just a pile of microbes. These things do a lot of things to keep us healthy.
So if a person has to take an antibiotic, it's a good idea to take a probiotic with it.
Well, that's what they finally came out and said in this article that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Well, they've also found that 30% of people on antibiotics stop taking them due to the diarrhea that's being caused by the antibiotics.
Well, it's like, duh. I mean, I remember arguing with a gastroenterologist about 10, 15 years ago saying, you know, we should really be using probiotics in people who have C. diff and people who have antibiotic-induced problems with diarrhea. And they said, where's the data? Where's the data? And I said, look, it's not a dangerous thing. Why don't you just try it and see what happens? Oh, no, we can't do that. Well, now they're the ones saying, hey, you guys should try probiotics. You may find out they're useful.
And, you know, in some cases, probiotics work without the antibiotics because they crowd out the bad bacteria.
Exactly. That's, you know, people have candida. I mean, the biggest example of this is people who are in the hospital who have C. difficile enterocolitis, which is developed because there are C. diff bugs there that are pretty resistant that are passed around, but also because there's so many people on antibiotics. And this is a serious illness that kills people. And you could do a lot just using a probiotic and a little bit of L-glutamine and some of the substances that can be used to provide a lot of nutrients to the gut. And in my experience, almost everybody with C. diff gets well that way. Anyway, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back taking your calls, and we have some waiting after Vicki's final 2020 tip.
Oh, I have some tips on old age.
Uh-oh.
60's the worst age to be, said the 60-year-old man. You always feel like you have to pee, and most of the time you stand there and nothing comes out. Ah, that's nothing, said the 70-year-old. When you're 70, you don't have a bowel movement anymore. You take laxatives, you eat bran, you sit in the toilet all day, and nothing comes out. Well, actually, said the 80-year-old, 80's the worst age of all. Well, do you have trouble peeing, too, asked the 60-year-old. Nope, pee every morning at 6 o'clock. I pee like a racehorse on a flat rock. No problem at all.
What?
So do you have a problem with your bowel movement? Nope, have one every morning at 6:30. Well, exasperated, the 60-year-old said, you pee every morning at 6 and crap every morning at 6:30. So what's so bad about being 80? I don't wake up until 7.
Oh, geez, Vicki, you're ruthless.
Well, since laughter is the best medicine.
I can't wait.
I got another one for you. This is dedicated to all of us who are seniors, to all of you who know seniors, and to all of you who will become seniors.
With a little luck, yeah.
So where's my Sunday paper? Well, the irate customer calling the newspaper office demanded to know where her Sunday edition was. Ma'am, said the newspaper employee, today is Saturday. The Sunday paper's not delivered until tomorrow on Sunday. There was this long pause on the other end of the phone, followed by a ray of recognition as she was heard to mutter, well, doggone it, that explains why no one was at church either.
Oh, geez, Vicki. You're funny. All right, the lines are open. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We have a call from Pam from New Jersey. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
How are you?
Hi, good. So, I had a 2% shot of lidocaine in my two right fingers to remove two warts.
Uh-huh.
And my right elbow swelled, and my right knee swelled, and on the very top of my stomach it swelled more on one side than the other.
Oh, boy.
And that's gotten a little solid, and now I was worried about cancer.
Oh,
and,
no,
and,
no.
I
think if you just had an injection of lidocaine in your fingers, okay, that the swelling that you're having in your joints and in your belly are probably related to the injection. I mean, you'd have to think that there's a sequence there that makes sense. And go ahead.
Yeah, I got the shots August 30th, and I'm still having problems and swelling and...
Oh, this was a long time ago.
Yeah, August 30th last year.
Well, have you been to your doctor since?
Have
you been to your doctor since that time?
I had a migraine all night, and I woke up, and my right knee was twice the size, back and front, of swelling in my elbow.
Okay. Well, here, Pam, when you're talking about things that have been around for a long time, trying to date it back to an injection in August, and you're still having ongoing symptoms, is probably not very likely. What you need to do is see a good healthcare practitioner who can give you some advice about what's going on. And if you're having migraine headaches on top of it, I mean, that's even more complex. So I think you need somebody who knows what they're doing, who can do a workup for this, and try and give you some guidance in the best way to manage it. So do you have a doctor?
No, and I'm on Medicaid, so all the doctors are bad, and I'm really angry that we don't have homeopathic doctors on Medicaid or anywhere insured.
Well, you're right. I mean, the Medicaid system is really pathetic. It's like our Medi-Cal system in California. You just can't get the care that you need, and it's why the U.S. healthcare system is ranked 37th in the world.
Every time I go to one, I get more harmed, so I really would like just homeopathic doctors.
Yeah, well, I don't know that a homeopathic doctor would help you any more than a really good allopathic doctor in this setting, but certainly you should find, if you could, I mean, you deserve to have one. I don't know how to give you advice. I can't give you advice because you're not my patient, but if you go to my website at drsaputo.com, and you join, which is free, you will be able to get information about things like this. We have some health assessments on people who have asthma and allergies, and you probably want to take those to learn more about what you might be able to do about this, although it's not intended as advice either. It's intended as information. You need to find a doctor, and I don't know how you're going to do that, but I think I'm going to leave it there because that's the best we can do on a show like this. So. Thanks for calling in, and I hope that I hope you find what you need. Vicki, you know that this problem with health care in America is a disaster. We have the best, without any question, the best health care system in the world. It's number one by far, but it's ranked by the World Health Organization.
Number 37.
Well, there's a reason for that, and that's because of the health disparities. You've got people on Medicaid like poor Pam here, who can't get the care that she needs, and you've got rich people, you know, who can go out and buy the hospital if they want or buy the doctor they want and get any kind of care there is, and it's not fair. I mean, health care is not a privilege. It's a right. You shouldn't have to pay for that. That's why, you know, when we were in Italy and I was sick about 30 years ago, we went into the hospital. They gave me all the treatment that I needed, didn't send us a bill for a penny, and sent us home. And a lot of countries are like that. Panama's like that. We were just reading about it yesterday.
And Aruba.
Yeah, and Aruba.
Aruba.
It's amazing how some countries are oriented to try and serve people, and other countries don't give a stuff about poor people or the working class people, and they just try to milk them for every dollar they can get by raising their taxes and not taxing people who have all the money. Something's wrong with that picture. It's terrible to have the best health care system available and only going to a few people. I mean, look what our Congress people get. I mean, they get the unbelievably good health care. They should be getting the same health care that poor Pam is getting, you know, on Medicaid. I think they'd change it quick if they had that for a service because they wouldn't stand it for a minute. It's terrible that corporate America is doing some of the things it's doing that's taking care of people. Very disappointing and wrong. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888- 877-4-4888.
People who want to be doctors usually start out caring for people as one of the reasons that they pursue a career in medicine.
Right.
And yet with time, many of them become desensitized to patients' emotions and feelings.
Yeah, for sure.
So now there's finally something that's being done about this.
A little something, not much, but it's a step in the right direction.
Well, it's reassuring.
Well, it's that at least somebody's noticed it. I mean, the Journal of General Internal Medicine published this study that came out of the Massachusetts General Hospital that showed that with a little bit of training, showing how important empathy is and caring for people, that the residents change their tune a little bit. You know, the doctors in training aren't the problem. It's the teaching system that's the problem.
Well, they don't have very good role models.
Well, the role models are terrible because they're coming out having this attitude they have. They come in with a great attitude. They want to save the world, okay? They're doing as many good things as they can. And then they get to medical school. And I remember when I was back at where I was trained, and they're saying, you're a scientist now. You be detached from your patients. Don't you get connected to them. This thing about relationship will take away your objectivity. And I'm going, what?
Well, think about Grand Rounds. What's that like? You know, here's a doctor with a group of residents talking around a patient that's lying there, and they're not talking to the patient. They're not seeing the patient as a human being.
They're just
seeing them as the patient in room 364 that's got the gallbladder or whatever it happens to be, and they're just talking around them.
Yeah, well, it's true, and it's humiliating, and it's impersonal, and it's so disrespectful.
So the good news is that now they have this three-hour program for medical residents and medical students that improves their empathy with the patients, and the patients are noticing it.
Well,
and it's only a three-hour program. Well, you know, I think
the
main thing is that they're acknowledging it and recognizing it.
Well, 99 residents out of the tens of thousands, okay, now have some kind of idea what's going on. The problem is we got to go back to those professors in their ivory towers who are doing research that don't have that much time they spend with patients anyway, and they're giving recommendations and advice to the residents and the interns and the medical students.
But anyway, it's not all just because of their role models. It's also because they're doing a lot of painful procedures. Sometimes to protect themselves from their own stress, they kind of desensitize.
Well, I mean, you're doing something like a biopsy or a bone marrow or a test like that. I mean, let's face it, it hurts. And you're the person there who's rushed because you've seen a lot of patients that day, and you're trying to just get through the day, and the tendency is to say, please hold still, it's going to hurt a little bit. And then, wacko, you know, the pain is terrible, and you know, just, you know, we'll, thank you very much, we'll be back with the result in a few days. That's not the way a healer behaves.
Well, the other thing, too, that we've talked about so much is how often that the medical residents are fatigued. They're overtired, and so...
Well, they're abused. I mean, let's face it. They're basically working, at least when I was in my training, we were on for 36 hours straight, off for 12, and did that for months at a time. It's no wonder why there are the rates of alcoholism and drug use and divorce and suicides are so high in people like that. You know, 11% of medical students can contemplate suicide? That was published in a paper that reviewed that
topic. Well, I can't
wait
to go to a teaching hospital.
Yeah, really. Well, you can't wait to go to any hospital because every place you go, you're going to have, what, a doctor who's been through this training. And it's not like they're all that way because there are some healers that are fantastic people that I applaud. But they've got to be the exception, not the rule, because of the way we're trained.
Well, now they're finally acknowledging this. So that's a good step.
Well, it's a little tiny statement, okay? It's like a drop of water in the ocean. It's a start. But if that's not going to be, for me, something that I'm going to say, well, medicine has changed now. I mean, I still look back at the way people in training are abused, and the fact that the doctors on the outside who are on the teaching staff don't do something about it. I mean, why wouldn't they do it? And the answer comes down to what? Dollars. Why? Because what happens if you try to replace one surgical resident? It'll cost you $1.5 million over their training. And if you got 150 or 200 residents in your program, do the math. You're going to see an issue
cheap
here.
Labor.
It is cheap labor. And it's crappy service as well. Would you like to be the patient that comes in when somebody's been up for 34 or 35 hours and can hardly concentrate? because they're so tired, and be their patient, especially when you don't know that much because you're still in your training. It's like, hello, and then you wonder why things are like they are. Anyway, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We have a call from Sandy from Florida. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Len.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, pretty good.
Well, that's good to hear.
I was just on a dose of antibiotics, and I wanted to know what kind of probiotic I should go on, and how long do you stay on a probiotic?
That's
or is
a
that
really,
something you do all the time?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sandy. And basically, most of the probiotics that are out there have billions of microbes in them. You can also get them from fermented sauerkraut, which is a great way to get it, or from yogurt. So you may want to add that to what you do.
But yogurt's probably not enough.
No, and maybe, but the sauerkraut probably is. But it's an interesting thing to add to it. I think most of the ones that are health food stores are pretty good. If you have a doctor, there is one called VSL number 3 that has like 100 billion in it. It's really powerful. And it's prescription, so you can get reimbursed for it. That's if you have a good healthcare system. If not, go to your health food store and just get one. And then generally, if you've been on antibiotics for, you know, a few days or a week or two, the microsystem, the ecosystem of the gut has 1,000 or more different species of microbes in it. And it takes, it's like a forest fire going through a forest, destroying that complex ecosystem you see with different kinds of trees, and et cetera, et cetera. And once the forest fire goes through there, you don't just take a few redwood seeds and throw it out there with a few ferns and other plants and think that you're going to have a forest back for a long time. And it's the same thing in the intestinal tract. So I would say for at least a few weeks, a few months, or maybe even a year, depending on what your GI tract is like. And again, this isn't advice because I'm not your doctor. This is something that I do for my own patients. But because you people out there listening to this aren't my patients, I can't give you advice, so you have to run that past your healthcare practitioner. So that's a
right.
great question, Sandy. So thanks
okay.
for calling.
Thank you.
And you
Take
have
care.
A great day. All right.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
You too.
Okay, bye. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. Number is 888-874-4888.
Well, addictions are hard to break. I mean, when we think of addictions, we usually think of alcohol and drugs, and we joke about being chocoholics and carboholics, and we refer to smoking as a habit. And now we have Facebook addicts and texting addicts. And before you start laughing about it, though, let's talk about the symptoms of an addict because it's serious.
Well, that's right. So you're looking at somebody who, if they can't get on their Facebook or they don't have a way of doing their texting, and they can't find their phone, or their computer's broken, and their hard drive is all buggered up, then you've got a problem, because they get agitated, and they don't feel comfortable, and they're shaking. I mean, I know people who are so connected to that if that's not there, they feel like they've gone out of the house without their clothes.
Well, they have trouble. They just, you know, trying to cut back, and they're too restless if they can't use it, and... You know you're addicted if it has a negative effect on your job or your schoolwork.
I'll say. Well,
this social media addiction is becoming more and more common all the time.
Well, I think that's right.
And I think that they talked in this article anyway about the types of personalities that tend to be more addictive would be people that are socially insecure and anxious might tend to be more addicted to the social media.
Yeah, this tends to be younger people, and for some reason women seem to be more vulnerable to it, according to this article, too.
They say because they like to socialize more and so forth, and that they can hide behind the computer screen.
Yeah, and face-to-face stuff, it's a whole lot different, and that's why, in some ways, it builds your skills, you know, of being more social. But I think there's a limit to it, and it's a great thing to do with some control. And I think that the kids that fall asleep texting and they have a computer screen still on, parents just shouldn't allow that to happen. There should be boundaries that we all follow that are oriented to making sure that this doesn't become an addiction that interferes with their life. And you do want to have some face-to-face contact. Hello.
Well, then speaking of addictions and habits, you know, What about Chantix to quit smoking?
How about
something non-toxic without potentially dangerous side effects? Well, the American Journal of Medicine says to try standard approaches before trying alternatives.
Hello.
So what are the standard approaches? Drugs.
I mean, Chantix. I mean, how that drug got on the market is beyond me. When you've got suicidal ideation and suicides associated with it.
And Zyban, too, is another one.
Well, yeah, but Chantix is really worse. I mean, it's a disaster. And people are still prescribing it because why? You look at the plus of what it does and say, oh, it might help me quit smoking, and indeed it might. But at the same time, it puts you at risk for these other things, too. And then for an article that looks at acupuncture and looks at hypnosis and looks at infrared light, it says, yep, you should do the standard things first and then consider these alternatives afterwards. Gives me a pain in the backside. I mean, hello, acupuncture works as well as Chantix does, and so does hypnosis, and infrared light therapy works even better if you use it as an acupuncture device.
Well, the thing about quitting smoking or anything else, I think that you need in your mind to really want to quit.
Right. Well, you smoked years ago. What did you go through? How did you do it?
Well, actually, I went to a group. It was the American Cancer Society.
They have a good program.
They had a good program. And so I did it through that. It was probably kind of like an AA sort of a deal.
Well, I remember you telling me after it was over, because we weren't participating in that together at the time, that you saw a picture of somebody's lung and it looked like it was black. It squeezed hard out of it. Yeah.
And it was crisp.
Yeah,
it was pretty disgusting.
I mean, it's not like people don't know all the things about smoking that are bad.
Well, see, one of the things was that I figured that if I really wanted to quit bad enough, I would find a way to do it. But I wasn't really wanting to enough, so I went to this group thinking that maybe they would say or do something to get me to quit. No, it was gradual. It was like over a period of time, you keep cutting back on the amount you smoke. But anyway, that's what worked for me.
Well, you did it. You know, that was a long time ago, and thank you very much. The secondhand smoke is no longer in our house.
Since 1980.
All right, we're at the end of the show here. I want to thank you all for joining us. We'd like to remind you that we'll be back live to talk about what's new in the news and health, and take your health questions every Monday afternoon on PRN.FM. and drsaputo.com from 1 to 2 Eastern Time and 10 to 11 Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health is also archived in drsaputo.com as well as prn.fm.
And if you've enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics that we discussed, you can go to drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos located on drsaputo.com under Radio. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
I want to thank the Tides Inn here in Bodega Bay for allowing us to use their little studio. And we'll see you next week.